to be here, and in fact I feel very honored to be to have been invited by PIMS for this occasion. The subject of the lectures, as Ian said, is algebraic ZD actions. There are two things which I should explain about the title. The first part of it is what's so special about ZD. Why is it? I mean, in harmonic analysis, for example, the transition from Z to ZD is not that spectacular. In dynamics, some really interesting things appear to happen when you talk instead of one ergodic transformation, which is the subject of classical ergodic theory, to several commuting ergodic transformations. And the reason for this, I hope, will become a little clearer as we develop the various aspects of it. Let me start by giving you a very short overview of what these lectures are going to be about. So the first lecture today is, of course, introduction. And I'll make a few introductory remarks about ZD actions, and in particular about algebraic ZD actions. The second lecture will be about some connections between algebraic ZD actions, and in particular their higher order mixing behavior, which I'll explain, and some very profound number theoretic results, so-called S-unit theorems, in characteristic zero and in positive characteristic. And it turns out that several of these theorems are practically equivalent to dynamical statements about these ZD actions. So this is mixing properties and S-unit theorems. The third lecture introduces a topic which really stood right at the beginning of people's interest in ZD actions. It's the rigidity properties of these actions. It turns out that these actions are individually composed of transformations which are Bernoulli, and to those who have heard these terms before, it means that these are very non-rigid transformations. You can deform them. There are lots of isomorphisms between them. There are lots of transformations which commute with the Bernoulli automorphism. But if you put two of them together, all of a sudden you get a system, or you may get a system, which has nothing commuting with it except for the elements of the original action. Now, the rigidity properties I'm going to concentrate on is isomorphism rigidity. So you take two such actions, and you assume that they are isomorphic in the weakest sense, usually under consideration in ergodic theory. It means that there is a measurable transformation between the two measure spaces, which sends one action to the other. Then it turns out, under appropriate conditions, that every such measurable conjugacy is in fact an affine map of the groups. So, in other words, there are very few isomorphisms between them, and it also makes it very easy to tell whether two systems are measurably conjugate. That's the main theme of ergodic theory, is to tell when two transformations are the same. And the same means that they're measurably conjugate in the sense which I've just very sketchily described. So here it turns out that measurable conjugacy implies a much, much stronger form of conjugacy, and because of the context in which this was probably came up surprisingly the first time, it's sometimes called Ratner rigidity. It's the phenomenon where not only different things, if they are isomorphic, they're also algebraically conjugate, but each conjugacy itself has to be algebraic, so there is no way of deforming anything. And the rigidity properties turn out to be much better understood in the zero-dimensional case. So I'll explain what exactly is zero-dimensional in a moment. And in the connected case, that's the fourth lecture. So in the zero-dimensional case, this means that so an algebraic ZD action, maybe I should get my act together and tell you what an algebraic ZD action is. It's a ZD action by automorphisms of a compact abelian group. Now, zero-dimensional just means that the group which is being acted on is zero-dimensional, and here it means that the group is connected. And the last lecture introduces homoclinic points and the construction of isomorphisms between such actions. As one goes through the list, less and less is known about the topic. So by the end, by the time we've reached the last lecture, we'll be talking about areas where nobody has any idea what it's about. But at least there'll be lots of open problems for you to try. So let me come back to the first topic, introduction. And as I said, if you take classical ergodic theory, you have actions of Z, or perhaps if it's not invertible, of the natural numbers, or could suspend these actions and look at flows. Just means that you add one more dimension to the whole system, there is a fairly straightforward way of passing between these two, and there is an equally straightforward way of replacing actions of the natural numbers, in other words, non-invertible transformations, by invertible transformations. So that's not going to be much of a problem. But right from the beginning of ergodic theory, statistical mechanics has again and again looked at examples where you have several commuting transformations. So this corresponds to, say, physical media with higher dimensional symmetry groups, like an infinite lattice system where at each lattice site you have various configurations, where there are some constraints about neighboring configurations, and you want to know something about the statistical behavior of such a system. So you've got for example, the dimer system. That's a good example. It's old, it's been studied a lot, and it is very easy to describe. You take Z squared, and the system consists of all possible configurations where you link exactly two neighboring lattice sites. It's obvious why this is called dimer system, because each of these molecules, if you like, consists of precisely two atoms. It's also easy why you could call it the domino system. You just fatten these lines, and then you get dominoes, which I'm not drawing very well. So these would be 2x1 dominoes. And you look at all possible ways of tiling the plane by such dominoes. That's the space. And because the whole arrangement is obviously spatially homogeneous, you can let the translation group act on the set of all such tilings. And you can ask, for example, what are the invariant measures? What is the topological entropy? In other words, what is the number of possible allowed configurations you can have in a large square? So the entropy here is the topological entropy, you count the number of configurations of size capital N by capital N. You just draw a large box and you look at the things which you can see in that box. It doesn't mean that dominoes could stick out of such a configuration. It just means you look through a window and you look at all the possible patterns you can see. You count the number of patterns. You take the logarithm of that. You would expect this number of configurations to grow exponentially with the size of the rectangle or square. And then you divide by the area of the rectangle. And this converges to a number which is called the topological entropy of the shift action, the domino shift, on this system. That's actually maybe a little sloppy, but it's a correct definition of topological entropy. Here it's very simple, because the state space is finite. At each lattice site, you have only four possible states you can have. This lattice site can be connected to one of its four neighbors, and you just make a note of which neighbor it has been connected to. So at each lattice site, you have an alphabet, if you like, consisting of four letters, up, down, left, and right. Then there is an adjacency condition. If this lattice site is connected to this neighbor here, then this lattice site must be connected to this neighbor. That's the rule. And then you just count the number of configurations, and it turns out to be, this number will have some significance perhaps in the last lecture, it's 1/4 times the integral of the logarithm of 4 minus 2 cosine 2 pi s minus 2 cosine 2 pi t from 0 to 1 ds dt. This formula was proved by a physicist, Castellane. Does he have the right number? Maybe he should only have one L. Castellane. And it's not something which you would think of immediately when you look at dominoes. What else is known about this? It is known that this system has the so-called Bernoulli property, which means that you can define it either as saying that it's abstractly, in the sense which I started off with, as a measurable dynamical system. It's conjugate to a Bernoulli shift. You could say it's maximally disordered, whatever that may mean. Or you could say, and this is the practical use of it, it is measurably conjugate to anything else which is also Bernoulli and has the same entropy. We'll come across another system today, which is an algebraic dynamical system and which has the same entropy. And it's not really understood at all why these two systems should be isomorphic. So this is one of the few examples of a Z-squared action arising in statistical mechanics or anywhere else. I mean, something which is kind of natural in the sense of the way physicists claim to be dealing with nature, where one can actually say something. There is another example . This is a fairly short list of examples of Z-squared actions, of physical Z-squared actions one can say something about. And the shortness of this list is one of the problems of the subject. It's difficult to construct examples of Z-squared actions which one can investigate. The second example are the three colored chessboards. So again, you've got the lattice, and you attach a color to each lattice site, and the number of colors you have available is 3. Let's just pause for a moment and think what happens if you only have 2 colors available. And this is, by the way, a chessboard coloring, so no 2 adjacent sides or squares should have the same color. If you have only 2 colors available, you get 2 possible allowed configurations. You get the chessboard pattern, the usual black and white pattern, with the origin colored white, or the other one is the one with the origin colored black. So that's a fairly simple dynamical system. You have 2 points in it, and the shift action just permutes the 2 points. If you shift it 1 step in either direction, then you get the other configuration. With 3 colored chessboards, it's much more interesting. There are uncountably many ways of coloring Z squared, and it's not so obvious how many ways there are. So here, the topological entropy to remind you, you look at, say, a large square or a large rectangle. The important thing is if you use rectangles and let them grow is that both sides grow. You shouldn't just have a long strip which doesn't increase its width. You look at the possible allowed colorings of that square or rectangle. You count the number of configurations you see. You take the logarithm and you divide by the size. And then by some fairly simple subadditivity argument, it turns out that the topological entropy of the shift actions, sigma, I will not put a subscript, but it's the shift action on these chessboards. If you have such a chessboard, infinite chessboard, and you shift it, you just get another configuration where all the colors have been shifted by a certain amount, maybe to the left and down. And the entropy of that is 1/2 logarithm of 64 divided by 27, which is the result of a very remarkable calculation by Elliot Leeb. He was interested in it because this system is practically the same as another system which is of interest in statistical mechanics. It's the square ice model. You have a lattice site, and these are molecules which like to borrow electrons from each other. I'm not going to, since I don't understand any physics, I'm not going to explain anything about it. But what it means is that at each lattice site, you have 2 arrows pointing towards neighbors and 2 arrows coming in from one of the neighbors. So at this lattice site, you could have, say, these 2 arrows pointing away from the site and these 2 arrows pointing towards the site. Here, you'd have, let's say, this is an incoming and outgoing arrow. Let's make this one outgoing. Now we need another incoming, and so on. So the rules are, again, very simple. Each lattice site has 2 arrows pointing away from it, 2 arrows pointing towards it, and the adjacency condition is just that the arrows shouldn't conflict. Again, you have a finite alphabet. At each lattice site, there is only a finite number of possible configurations or patterns of arrows, and there's a kind of nearest neighbor compatibility condition again. And if you want to know what the connection between the 3 color chessboard and this is, just point an arrow whenever you have used one of the 3 colors of your chessboard. The color to the right can either be 1 up or 1 down cyclically. So you just say, take the colors 0, 1, and 2, and if you go up, So this would be, say, if you had the color 0 here, this would mean you have the color 1 here because you've got an arrow going this way. Here you have to have color 0 because you have an arrow going up, well, going down here. Here you would have to have 2. Here you would have 2 again. Here you have 2. Here you have 2, and so on. Is it clear? Whenever you see an arrow, you go round this little diagram of the digits 1, 2, and 3. Okay? Have I done something wrong?
Yeah, there I think you have a 3 and 1 there.
No, from 2, the arrow goes up here, and 2. To go, if you go along an arrow from 2, you have to go to 0.
But then the horizontal arrow goes from 2 to 2.
Oh, that's because it's yes, quite right. Something wrong here. 0. 2 in, 2 out. I suspect we have not discovered the basic inconsistency in nature, but. 2, 0.
Can you not extend the arrows? It sort of looks like.
Yeah, I should have thought about this more carefully. Maybe you have to. You go 0, 1, 2. Maybe you have to turn the vertical arrows around.
Yeah,
I think you have to turn the vertical arrows around. That's the secret of the mystery. So the vertical arrows, this is for horizontal and for vertical. If you get bored with what I'm saying, you can check whether this works out all right. So the vertical arrows go around the other way. So, modulo minor details like whether this is actually correct or not. You have, if you see the arrow pattern, you have got one choice at one of the lattice sites to decide which color you put there, and then all the other colors are determined. So in other words, the square ice model is a 3-to-1 factor of the chessboard. Because given a coloring of the chessboard, you know how to draw your arrows, or at least maybe you do. And if you know how to draw the arrows, you can reconstruct the coloring of the chessboard, provided you are told the color at any particular single site. So this says that these two models are closely related. One of them is a 3-to-1 factor of the other, and they have the same entropies because a finite-to-1 map, if you look at this expression, a finite-to-1 map, if you take logarithms and divide by something large, will not make any difference. So this is conjectured to be Bernoulli. But to my knowledge, there is no complete proof of this at this stage. So these are two examples. There's maybe a third example, which is also very classical and is also deceptively simple. It's called the hard ball model, or maybe the hard core model, but that is perhaps not such a good description. It's again a lattice where at each lattice site you can either have a particle or no particle. And these particles don't like each other, so you never have two particles at neighboring lattice sites. So there's at each site either one or zero particles, and no particles next to each other. Here the entropy is not known. You can, of course, count configurations here moderately easily, but there is no exact value of the entropy. So the entropy known only approximately. And if you look at the proofs of those results about such models which have actually been obtained, they are complicated, and there is no general method. And that is one of the main difficulties of these systems, which are called multidimensional, and in this case two-dimensional, two or d-dimensional, shifts of finite type. Which are all described as follows. You have a finite alphabet. So here the alphabet, I pointed that out, is the link from the lattice site to that other lattice site to which it's connected. So it's one of four directions. Here the alphabet would just be one of the three colors. Here the alphabet would be one of the six possible configurations of arrows at the lattice site. And here the alphabet is 0 and or 1, depending on whether there is a particle sitting at the site or not. Then there is a finite set F, which you might want to call the window. Then there are the set of things P in A to the F. These are the allowed... Oh, this is finite. Finite size, and this is a subset of z to the d. Let me do it in general. D is 2 in all these examples, and these are the allowed configurations. So they are those things which you actually want to see in that window. So for example, here for the hard ball model, you could choose as your window this set, and then you just have the rule that if there is a 1 here, you have to have zeros here and here. And the configurations which are allowed are those where you have the property that wherever you place the window, so the space X, which is defined by these data, the window, and the things you want to see through the window, this is the set of all points in A to the Z to the D, so this would be all possible configurations, with the property that wherever you take a point, you shift it, so we have sigma to the nx, the mth coordinate of that is just x to the m plus n. Such a point x, these are just the coordinates of the point, right? So you have a shift action. The shift action is, the way I've written it, it's kind of left, to the left and down. So you take a point, you shift it anywhere, and then you look at it through the window F. Then you see something in P for all n in Zd. That's the definition of a multidimensional shift of finite type. It's a finite type because the window is finite. There's some finite set in which you prescribe what you want to see or what you want to exclude. So here, for example, the configurations you could see are 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, and so on, 1, 0, 0. But, for example, you could not see this here. That would not be allowed. That would be something which is not in P. In this example, can you see past this thing here? Or here for the three-color chessboard, you could do something like this. You could choose the same window, and you just demand that the colors, that this point should not have the same color as either of its neighbors. So the data which you need are very simple, and the definition is a general definition. You've got a finite set. Every time you do something like this, you get a shift of finite type. The problem is, I'm sure you've heard this before, that the initial data, F and P, do not... there is no algorithm where you feed in the initial data F and P and you get out whether the shift space is non-empty or not. This is one of the classical undecidability problems. Of course, like all these things, it gets reduced to a word problem. But it's something which has plagued this subject right from the beginning. And although in all these examples it's extremely easy to determine whether there are points in the space or not, this undecidability problem is kind of at the root of the difficulty of finding general methods in this subject. Every time you want to describe an infinite class of shifts of finite type, which you want to investigate, the class is either very unsatisfactory or you can't say anything about it. There was there were two early papers by Markley and Paul on this subject. And they tried, they very valiantly battled against these difficulties and tried to find a class of shifts of finite type with some additional conditions about which you could say something. Well, the first thing you find is that somebody comes from statistical mechanics and says, yes, but this system doesn't fall under your restrictions. The second difficulty is that you still can't say anything about the systems, even with these restrictions. So it's a fascinating subject, but it's full of ad hoc methods, and the ad hoc methods are all very difficult. It's, in that sense, it's reminiscent of the closely related subject of percolation theory. There are all these models. They're all very appealing because they look kind of natural, and it's extremely difficult to prove anything about a single model or, more ambitiously, about whole classes of models. So this was one of the sources of the ergodic theory of ZD actions, but there were two other examples which are maybe not as old as these models of statistical mechanics, which were also intriguing, but of mathematical origin this time. The first of these runs under times 2 and times 3 and appears in a paper by Fürstenberg from the year, I wrote it down somewhere, I hope I did, 1967. Let's see. And it consists of the two transformations. X goes to 2x mod 1. And x goes to 3x mod 1. So these are two commuting transformations of the unit interval. They are not automorphisms like the previous examples where we looked at the shift action. But it's very easy to... Let me do this. Let me extend this to a system consisting of two commuting automorphisms. So extend two automorphisms of a compact abelian group, in other words, to an algebraic z-squared action in the sense of the original, of the title of these talks. And you do it as follows. You define x, so t is just r mod z, and you define a subgroup of t to the z-squared, and you define it as follows. It's the set of all points x. So again, we look at the coordinates of a point, so this is each underlined n here is a pair of integers, and each xn is an element of t, and they should have the property that x n1 n2 sorry n1 plus 1 comma n2, in other words, you look at the coordinate to the right of a given one, then that corresponds to multiplication by 2. That's one rule. And if you look at the coordinate above, n1, n2 plus 1, this is 3x1, x2, n1, n2. All this mod 1. And this should be for all n equal to n1, n2 in z squared. So this is a closed shift invariant subgroup. And if you take x, then here you take the shift, say, on k symbols to the left and l symbols down. You project this down to the circle by sending a point just to its zeroth coordinate. Zero is a double zero here. This is the point zero in z squared. Then this corresponds to times 2 to the k, 3 to the l. Okay? We've chosen our coordinates. If you take a point and shift it one step to the left, you've multiplied all its coordinates by 2. If you shift it one step down, you have multiplied all its coordinates by 3. So this non-invertible system, which we had defined here, is obtained from this invertible system just by projection onto a single coordinate. So why did Fürstenberg look at this? He got interested in, or he proved in this paper, the following thing. Let me go back one step. If you just look at multiplication by 2, there are many closed invariant subsets of the unit interval. It means multiplication by 2 is easily translated in terms of dyadic expansion of numbers, of real numbers between 0 and 1. And you could look, for example, at the set of all real numbers which have never 3 consecutive 1s in their dyadic expansion. That's a closed subset which is invariant under multiplication by 2. So there are lots of these subjects for each of these transformations, but there are no infinite closed invariant subsets other than the whole space for both transformations simultaneously. So every infinite closed invariant subset, and invariant means invariant under both these transformations, is equal to the whole space. So this is what Fürstenberg proved in this paper. And then there is a statement, I was talking to Ian about this earlier, which is always attributed to Fürstenberg, but it never appears in the paper it is usually attributed to. He asked the question, so we know about invariant sets. What do we know about invariant measures for these two transformations? Lebesgue measure is invariant if you take the right definition. A measure is invariant, so let's call this T2 and this is T3. Yeah, these are the transformations consisting of multiplication by 2 and by 3. A measure is invariant if for any Borel set B, the pre-images under multiplication by 2, not the image. If you take a small interval and you multiply it by 2, it gets longer. You can't expect the measure to be invariant under that. But if you look at the pre-images of a small interval under multiplication by 2, there are two intervals. Each one has half the length of the original one. So the measure of the inverse of a Borel set under multiplication by 2 should be unchanged, and the same thing should be true for multiplication by 3. So a probability measure on the unit interval is invariant under these two transformations, invariant under the system, if it satisfies this. Well, there is one measure which has this property, Lebesgue measure. I've just been proving it because we've been talking about length of intervals. If you take an interval, then here you get two intervals half the length, and here you get three intervals of one-third of the length each. So Lebesgue measure is invariant. Then there are some atomic measures. For example, the measure, the equidistributed measure on one-fifth, two-fifths, three-fifths, and four-fifths is invariant under this transformation. Are there any others? Don't tell me that you could do this with seventh. I want to have non-atomic invariant measures, which are non-atomic invariant probability measures on R. This question is still open as it was in 67. There are some partial results, which I will probably mention in lecture number 4, if my count is correct. So this is one simple system which, if you write it like this, is algebraic in the sense that it's defined by commuting automorphisms of a compact abelian group, and it leads to an interesting behavior and an unexpected behavior. It's a behavior which you would not expect from the properties of the constituent transformations. The other example is a little younger, but not that much younger. That's from 1978. If I continue like this, I'll need 10 lectures I'll try to move things along a little quicker. So the other example is due to Le Drapier, a 1978, and it's again a group X, this time it's a closed shift invariant subgroup of two-point groups, Z-squared, thank you, sorry. Yeah. And the rule is as follows. So again, we've got each point written in terms of coordinates. Each of these coordinates is a 0 or a 1. And the condition is that, I'll draw the condition. You look at this set, which we've looked at before a few times. The sum of the digits in each translate of this little window should be even, or it should be 0, not 2. So in the correct arithmetic, the sum should be 0. So this means that x, n1, n2, plus x, n1, plus 1, n2, plus x, n1, n2, plus 1, this is 0 for all n in z squared. This is a condition which is obviously shift invariant, so you have got the shift action on it, And you can ask, what are the properties of this action? Now, the first thing you can prove is that this action is mixing. I will only give an informal definition. Lecture 2 will introduce a more formal version of it. You look at the configuration, so in some region where you are, and then you look at another configuration. So you shift, you take two configurations. So you have B1, B2, and X. I'll write down the definition. These are two Borel sets. Think of them as cylinder sets defined by some finite set of coordinates. Then this is a group, so it has a Haar measure. Then lambda of B1, the original set, you take the second set and shift it a long distance away. As m tends to infinity, so these are points which at the origin look like B1, by the condition, satisfy the conditions of B1. And this measures whether you can tell at B1 what the constraints far away are. And if it's mixing, it means that this converges to the product of the two measures. This is precisely saying that the behavior here and the behavior a long way out at infinity is independent. Then there is something called higher order mixing. You can do this for three sets, and you can say, I want to know whether the original set B1, some sigma to the M1 or M2 B2, and a sigma to the M3 B3, so you have three sets, you move them, two of them to infinity, and you move them apart, and you want to know whether the behavior here, here, and here is independent. So three mixing would be that lambda of these intersections converges to lambda of B1, lambda of B2, lambda of B3, where lambda is, as I said earlier, the Haar measure on this group. As M2 tends to infinity, M3 tends to infinity, and the distance between M2 and M3 tends to infinity. So MI tends to infinity, and MI minus MJ tends to infinity. Well, in classical ergodic theory, right from the beginning of the subject, there was the question whether for a single transformation, for powers of a single transformation, mixing implies mixing of every order, in particular three mixing. I'm sure you can do K-mixing by now, you just take K-sets. Yeah? That problem is still unsolved. That's another famous old conjecture. Conjecture is that it's true. But this example, Le Drapier's example, has the property that it's mixing in this sense, two mixing, but not three mixing. And it's very easy to check that. We'll do that tomorrow. So this was again an odd behavior of a system of a very simple and elementary z-squared action, which, if you like, is surprising. Of course, it doesn't tell you anything about the original question at the roots of ergodic theory, but it's still a curious behavior that you have some long-term dependence of the behavior of points at different locations which are far apart, but you only notice this dependence if you impose conditions on all these sites. You never notice it, say, if you only use two patches of coordinates. Okay? This is just a little calculation here. It's not difficult. So let me... I'm getting slightly running out of time a little. So these were two old examples, both of which were very simple to state and had unexpected behavior. and which, if you like, lie at the root of the interest in the study of algebraic dynamical systems. So let me define properly for the first time what an algebraic ZD action is, and then give you a little bit of background and an illustration why these are so much nicer than the general class of ZD action, because there are a lot of things you can say about them immediately. First of all, the space is non-empty. That's nice, because a group is non-empty. It has the identity. But that's not very serious. So let's look at algebraic ZD action. So X is a compact abelian group. And N goes to alpha to the N is a homomorphism. So this is a ZD action by, of course, continuous. There are no other automorphisms. Of X. That's it. That's an algebraic ZD action. You could try and drop abelian. That doesn't bring you much. The non-abelian groups in this case are not interesting. We'll come to some more interesting non-abelian things maybe in a remark, but not right now. Okay, so that's the information. Exercise. Describe the dynamical behavior of all such actions. It's not quite as hopeless as the same question about multidimensional shifts of finite type, because you can actually do something here. Here's a very simple observation with very far-reaching consequences in spite of its triviality. If you have a compact abelian group X, it has a dual group. This is the homomorphism, the continuous homomorphisms from X into the circle group. I know that S is equal to T, but in fact it's written multiplicatively. This is multiplicative. So it's the set of all complex numbers of absolute value 1. So this is... Now, this was a compact abelian group, and this is a discrete abelian group. Which we'll always assume to be countable. That's the same as assuming that X is metrizable. Now, this group inherits also an action from... So here you've got the dual automorphism. So, the pairing AX is the value of A in X hat at X in X. Just notation. Now, look at the map. A goes to A, alpha to the MX. I'm sorry. I looked at it and I thought there's something wrong here. So look at this homomorphism. This is again a continuous homomorphism from X to the circle. So this is equal to some alpha hat M of A, X. And that's the definition of the dual action. That's the dual ZD action on X hat. So now we've got a ZD action on this compact, on this discrete abelian group, and I'm a little concerned, because if I rush this through, you won't understand anything in the following lectures. Do I have permission to overdraw? I will not make a habit out of it by a few minutes. So here we have a dual ZD action. You know this well. I mean, if you take a matrix acting on the N torus, the dual object is just the transpose matrix acting on Z to the N, if N is the dimension of the torus. So what I want to say, if you think this is obvious, then I should not say it at great length. This is a discrete abelian group. We have an action of Z to the D on this group, and this action immediately extends to a module, to an action of the group ring of Z to the D on this group. So what's the group ring of Z to the D? You take the Laurent polynomials in D variables, UD plus minus 1. Bear with me, this is A, it's not difficult, and B, it's important. So look at this ring of polynomials. Take a polynomial f and write it as the sum of fn u to the n, where u to the n is equal to u1 to the n1 ud to the nd. This is a finite sum. Each of these fn's is an integer, and there are only finitely many of these integers which are non-zero. Now you can define f acting on an element A. A is an element of x hat, as the sum of fn alpha hat n of A. You can do this. This is an automorphism of the dual group. You get something. You multiply them by integers, add them up, and you get an action of this ring here, RD, on this group X hat. So under this action, X hat becomes an RD module. That satisfies the appropriate distributive laws. You can easily check it. So we are now, we have an object in commutative algebra which describes exactly this action, because you can reconstruct X and the original action alpha from this information. So, for example, what is u to the m a? This is nothing but alpha to the m hat applied to a. So if you know this, you know this, then you know the dual automorphism, and you have the original action by this equation. So now we've got this module. This is the dual module. And you can ask how to translate the dynamical properties of X into properties of the module and vice versa. So you've got algebra to play with, you've got harmonic analysis to play with, and then, of course, you've got the standard repertoire of ergodic theory to play with as well. And by using these three machines, you can investigate these actions. And something I had originally wanted to do today is to write down a dictionary of module properties and dynamical properties of the action. But I'll do that tomorrow at the expense of some later stuff. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments?